Thank you, Father. Is this working? Every time I use a microphone like this, I'm reminded of the story of an Irish pastor who was, thank you, using a lavalier mic or mobile mic for the first time, and was convinced that it wasn't going to work, but sort of as skilled as technology as I am. And so he went out, began Mass. He said, "The Lord be with you." "There's something wrong with this microphone." And, of course, the people responded, "And also with you." So, if you can't hear, raise your hand in the back. This is primarily for me, so we get out of here. If you want to read those, some of the quotes I'm going to share I think are powerful, and I'd rather have you read them than listen to me read them. But and if you want the slides, I'll get them to Father and Gail, but this is primarily for me. It is great to be here, particularly at a university that takes this mission seriously. It's great to be here on this topic, on this purpose. But every time I'm introduced by my rather pompous title, I get a little nervous. I'm from Washington. We have lots of pompous titles. In fact, I have a new pompous title. I'm Director of Justice, Peace, and Human Development, which I figure is something that Dr. King and Dr. Phil would do together. But when Father mentioned my previous title, Secretary for Social Concerns, I always tell the story of being at one of the bishops' meetings, and I got on an elevator with a couple, and we have these very large name cards. And I could see they were looking at me sort of strangely and said, "Bishop's Conference, my name, my title." And finally the guy said to me, "You're not a bishop." And I don't know whether it was my wedding ring or the way I was dressed that gave me away. I said, "No, I'm not a bishop. I work for the bishops." And I could see he was reading the rest of the name card. And he turned to his wife and said, "He's in charge of social development and world peace." And she seemed a little underwhelmed by this. And she said, "You need to do a better job." So, the fact is, we all need to do a better job of connecting our faith and our public life, our roles as believers and voters, our responsibilities as Catholics and Americans. I'm happy to be here because the topic could not be more timely. But I'm always reminded, everybody's grandmother, my grandmother said, "You never discuss religion and politics in polite company." Well, she would not have come to tonight's lecture, and she would not have been there tomorrow. But I think it is an important topic, but my grandmother had a point that if we treat this combination badly, it can explode. It can be dangerous. It can explode in ignorance, intolerance, in a religious conflict, in ideological and partisan combat, and we've seen a lot of that, frankly. It's not an easy time to be here. I bring you greetings from Benedict the 16th. I spent yesterday with him. He was not aware of that, but I was. I wanted to say I'm not going to be here for Mass. I'm going to be in Omaha, but he didn't seem to care. It was an amazing experience. It was a beautiful day. He's candid, talking about the shame our church has experienced because of sexual abuse. I don't know if you've heard, he met with a group of victims, which I, as a parent and as someone who works with bishops in the church, think is an important step. He offered, at least in my experience, a very affirmative, very challenging message, particularly at the White House, where he talked about this topic. And the one thing that struck me, an 81-year-old man, our Holy Father, talked mostly about the future, except when it came to sexual abuse, where he owned the past. And he encouraged us to think about new ways to share the gospel. He acted as if the gospel is, in fact, good news. So, in terms of the papal visit, everybody has a job at the conference. My job was to say no to people. No, you will not get tickets. No, you will not be invited. And it was a great job, and I did it very well. It's good to be here because of where we are. This topic of faithful citizenship has moral dimensions, and I would argue it has academic dimensions. It certainly has important dimensions for a Catholic university. I looked at what you say about yourself, and it says, our Jesuit vision commits us to form women and men of competence, conscience, and compassion. We do this in service of a faith that does justice. I would argue that faithful citizenship is about producing people of competence, conscience, and compassion who put their faith to work in the service of justice. In your mission statement, Creighton is dedicated to the pursuit of truth, guided by the living tradition of the Catholic Church. That is a description of faithful citizenship. As a Jesuit university, you offer an integrating vision of the world that arises out of a knowledge and love of Jesus Christ. This is an attempt to offer an integrating vision of the world. A Creighton education is directed towards the promotion of justice, service to others, family life, the worth of each individual, ethnic and cultural diversity are core values to the mission of this university. Those are the substance of faithful citizenship, and that the faculty research to enhance teaching, to contribute to the betterment of society, and to provide ethical perspectives for dealing with an increasingly complex world. I think political life, public life, is one of the parts of our complex world that desperately needs ethical perspectives. So we're at the right place and the right topic. I am anxious, though, even though I'm happy to be here. The arrayed in front of me are the other people going to be here tomorrow, and you ought to come back tomorrow. We have the A-team here, and there are six or eight people here who should give this talk. And I want to be clear, I'm not calling on you during the question period. These are wonderful scholars and very thoughtful voices. And part of the reason I'm anxious is my credentials as an academic are pretty modest. When it comes to Catholic education, I'm a product of it, and I'm proud of that, and I pay for it, and I'm a little tired of that. My daughter, my youngest daughter, Molly, is a junior at Loyola College in Marymount, a Jesuit institution, and I tell my Jesuit friends, I said at dinner, the way the Jesuits practice the option for the poor is they're making me poor. I would like to talk to the financial aid guy before I leave. So even despite that, I'm happy to be here and I'm happy to be out of Washington. Washington is a sad place. It's a polarized place. It's a paralyzed place. Think of the empty, divisive, demonizing immigration debate. We couldn't agree on health care for children. We still don't have a common policy on Iraq. And part of the reason we're polarized and paralyzed is we're preoccupied with the elections. And some of it's worth being preoccupied by. This is an unusual election. This is the first time in about 50 years we do not have an incumbent president or vice president. That's unprecedented. It will also be the first time in 50 years that apparently we will have a senator elected president, which I don't think is good news, because that means all 100 members of the Senate think they should be president. And we shouldn't encourage them. The other reason I think we're preoccupied and, in fact, fascinated is this has been an amazing year. We may have the first woman. We may have the first African-American. We could have had the first Hispanic. We could have had the first Baptist minister, first Italian-American, first Mormon. I was struck, I was at one of the Republican debates, and one of the experts here is on family life, and as I looked at the leaders, there were like 12 marriages among the top four Republican candidates, and the only one who had been married to one woman was the Mormon, which was sort of stunning to me, and confusing. So I'm glad to be away, but I know I'm an outsider. I'm from the Midwest, but I'm not from Omaha. I'm from Minnesota. They all think we go to high school together, but I'm not going to tell you I shuck corn and all that. So I'm going to offer some perspectives, but I really feel like an outsider. It's a little bit like the story I tell all the time of a guest preacher who thought he had the right message and thought he had delivered it well at an important parish event. Well, he and the pastor stood in the back of the church when Mass was over. And most folks were kind and complimentary. But at the very end of the line, a guy came up, reached out his hand, and said, "You talk way too fast. It wasn't very helpful. You really had nothing to say." Well, this obviously concerned the preacher. He said, "Who is this guy, and what is his problem?" And the pastor looked at him and said, "Oh, don't worry about him. He just goes around repeating what everybody else is saying." So, I know I'm going to talk too fast. Hope I have something to say. Hope it might be helpful. But Dennis, you and I are not standing over at that door when this is over. These are the perspectives I bring. Professional perspectives. It's not an easy time to work at the Bishop's Conference. We've experienced some of the downsizing, some of the stresses that the rest of the church has, which is only right. But it's still a great place to see the strength and vitality of our church's social mission, to stand up for human life and dignity, to go to other lands and see people like the people in this room standing up for life and dignity in a way that make you proud. It's a chance to see our Holy Father stand in the White House and talk about peace, talk about justice, talk about life. Personally, I've been involved in public life. As a young man, I ran for office. There are worse things than running and losing, standing up for what you believe in. One message I have is more of us ought to do it. As Father said, I worked for the White House Conference on Families. I worked with Coretta King at the National Committee for Full Employment. But for me, the best place to advance this mission, my values, was trying to encourage this message of faithful citizenship. So this is home for me. I'm going to talk a lot about politics, so I think I better tell you where I come from. I am a product of a mixed marriage. Both my parents are Minnesota Catholics. My mother is from St. Paul and my dad from Minneapolis, which, as you know, is a big deal. But for purposes of this discussion, my mother, absolutely a committed Republican. Her family, her brother, my uncle, was the Republican leader of the Minnesota Senate. My dad is still a diehard Democrat, a proud pro-life Democrat. And my grandfather, his father, was Hubert Humphrey's finance chairman when he first ran for mayor. And there are three or four of us old enough to remember Hubert Humphrey. Another perspective I bring, and I know there are some students here, so just ignore this. I think when we talk about faithful citizenship, in part, my passion comes from being a parent. What kind of politics, what kind of country, what kind of church are our kids going to be a part of? I have four kids. We have four kids. I better get that right. They're all in their 20s now, hard to believe. We put up a good fight, but the inmates really tried to take over the asylum. Colette and I were talking. My boys are too old now, but they came home one time, and they were too old for a curfew. So we had the rule of reasonableness, which is they were to be home at a reasonable hour in reasonably good shape. And they violated that rule. And I found myself pacing my living room saying, "I hope they haven't had a car accident because I want to kill them myself." My two daughters, I nice said this father-daughter thing is very powerful. At least in high school, they sort of went in different directions. Kelly, who is at the University of St. Thomas, was something of a social activist on the life issues, for the unborn, the death penalty, the war. Molly, at least in high school, went in a different direction. She was a cheerleader and a member of the dance team. And I said to Linda at one point, "I feel like we're living in a house with Sister Helen Prejean and Britney Spears." Now, since then, Molly has made a lot better choices and Britney has made a lot worse choices. But the hardest thing I do, have ever done, is not helping the bishops apply Catholic teaching on war to Iraq, although that's hard. It's not testifying on climate change before the Senate, although that's challenging. The hardest thing I have ever done is helping to raise kids with Christian values in this culture. And part of what I want to communicate is a passion for politics that reflects our faith, and that's hard work. The other perspective I bring, and Father referenced this, I may be the only person on earth who worked on the first Faithful Citizenship Statement in 1976 and worked on the last one in 2008. That's 32 years. And you know what? That makes me really old, you know? I still think of myself as a young troublemaker, you know? And I said to Linda, we're no longer talking about our kids' dreams, we're talking about our procedures, you know? But so I'm sort of an old curmudgeon. I was thinking of old something else, but I don't think you ought to say that at a university. But so I bring some prejudice. I bring some challenges. I've experienced some opportunities. I have been in endless meetings at the Bishop's Conference around faithful citizenship, committee meetings, the meetings of the whole group. I have been in countless church basements, university auditoriums, cathedral settings, talking about this. And I said to the bishops, remember there was some talk about getting rid of limbo? I said, I don't mind what you do with limbo, but leave purgatory alone. Because I want all this time to count. Faithful citizenship has been a wonderful experience, political responsibility we used to call it, but a better count as time off purgatory. Here's what I want to do this evening. Talk about the mission of the church in public life, what it is and what it is not. The context for faithful citizenship, what are we up against in public life? What are our assets for faithful citizenship? We were talking on the way over. We focus a lot on our liabilities. And we can talk about that in the when we gather for refreshments. I'd like to just take 5 minutes and talk about our assets. And then I have a section on the history of political responsibility and faithful citizenship. And I'm going to treat a little bit of that in this lecture, but most of that's going to go in the paper. It's fascinating to me, and it will bore you to tears. But I think there are a couple insights that are worth sharing. And then I want to conclude with what is the message of this year's faithful citizenship? What are some of the distinctions made, the directions offered, the dangers, things? Here's what I will do and what I won't do. I will outline some of the history and some of the ways in which this document has developed over the time. I will try and summarize some of the principles, some of the ideas that guide this document. And I will offer at least my take on some of the directions and dangers for religious engagement in public life, especially in our Catholic community. I'm not going to be telling Catholics or anybody else who they should vote for or who they ought to vote against. I will not be offering my own commentary on the campaign. I come from Washington. Everyone's a pundit. Washington is a place where everyone knows everything, and everything they know is wrong. You know, the only thing you can predict about this campaign is whatever is predictable will not happen. I once read that the least credible sentence in the English language is, I'm from Washington, and I'm here to help. But I'm also going to make the case for the positive role of government in politics. And so, but my point is that starts here, not there. And I will try and contribute, maybe help start this conversation we're going to have over the next day and a half about the role of the church and Catholics in public life. So let's talk about mission. We're a church. We're a community of faith. We're not a lobby. We're not another interest group. We're not a PAC. What brings us together tonight, what brings us together over the next day and a half, is not politics. We disagree. We disagree to dinner. It's not ideology. I think I'm going to be a conservative in this group. We are not the Democratic Party of Prayer. We are not the Religious Caucus of the Republican Party. We are a community of faith. This is a community of faith and learning, this university. So what brings us together is the Word of God and the teaching of His church. I would suggest that the most countercultural thing our church teaches is not that all life is sacred. It's not that war ought to be a last resort. It's not that the poor ought to come first, although those are three countercultural thoughts. It is that politics is a good thing. It is a way we make decisions about some of the most important things in our lives. And so virtually every statement over these 32 years in its 8 versions has said responsible citizenship is a virtue, and participation in the political process is a moral obligation. You cannot be a faithful Catholic and wring your hands and sit on the sidelines of political life. It's an essential part of being an American, being a Catholic, and I would suggest it ought to be a central part of being a part of the family of Creighton, whether you're a faculty member, a staff member, a student, alumnus, or just a friend. This mission is not new. It's as old as the Hebrew Scriptures and the prophets. It's as central as Jesus' mission on earth. It's as clear as Matthew 25. And it's as urgent as what our Holy Father said yesterday on the White House lawn. It's as old as the Hebrew Scriptures. Choose life so that you and your descendants might live. Woe to you who enact unjust statutes and who write oppressive decrees. Isaiah. Why did Jesus come? I've come to bring life and bring it to the full. What was his mission on earth? We have that incredible story of him and his beginning his public life in his hometown synagogue in Nazareth, in front of his family of friends, walking up to the front, unrolling the scrolls, and choosing this passage from Isaiah. This was not the reading of the day. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He has sent me to bring good news to the poor, liberty to captives, new sight to the blind, and set the downtrodden free. That was Jesus' mission on earth. That is our task in political life today. It's as clear as Matthew 25. We only have one description of the Last Judgment, and there's really only one question. What did you do for the least of these? We're called to be the salt, the light, the leaven. That is our mission. And the measure, the moral measure of our lives, of our society, of every institution is how it touches the least among us. And yesterday, on the south lawn of the White House, our Holy Father said, the preservation of freedom calls for the cultivation of virtue, self-discipline, and sacrifice for the common good, and a sense of responsibility towards the less fortunate. Think about public life. A cultivation of virtue, self-discipline, sacrifice for the common good, and a sense of responsibility to the less fortunate. That does not sound like, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And then he goes on to say, it also demands the courage to engage in civic life and to bring one's deepest beliefs and values to reasoned public debate. That is what faithful citizenship is. The courage to engage in civic life and to bring one's deepest beliefs and values to a reasoned public debate. He said, in a word, freedom is ever new. What does it mean to choose life and to bring life to the full in a nation with 1 million abortions a year? In a world where more than 30,000 children will die today because of hunger and its consequences. How do we bring good news to the poor in a country with such incredible and growing gaps between rich and poor? How do we bring liberty to those held captive when we know how we can be held captive and others can be held captive, enslaved by discrimination or dependency or addiction? Think of the numbers we read about incarceration rates in our country. Our prisons are full of our young people. What does it mean to bring new sight to the blind when we know how we can be blinded by indifference or ignorance or prejudice or partisanship? I would suggest bringing new sight to the blind is a good description of the mission of a Catholic university. And how do we set the downtrodden free in a nation and a world where hope, as our Holy Father has suggested, is what is most at risk, in least supply? How do we bring one's deepest beliefs and values to reasoned public debates in the middle of this campaign, this election? Now, this kind of talk makes people nervous. They talk about separation of church and state. They lift up the First Amendment. First Amendment essential, important. It means we cannot have a state religion, and also protects the right of religious groups and peoples to participate in public life. I think when people talk about the wall, I think they're less worried about the Constitution and more worried about us. They would just soon see us be quiet. Shut up. For a lot of people, faith is fine. It's sort of like bowling, you know? I don't mind if you bowl, just don't talk about your bowling. It's a hobby, you know? Leave your bowling at home. I've never bowled. Apparently Barack Obama has never bowled either. I would never demonstrate that I've never bowled. They suggest that there is a danger to our church, to our faith, and to our government, and to our country, if we link these two. I would remind them, I would remind ourselves, we have the same rights, no more, no less, than any other group in society, any other citizen. We should expect neither favoritism nor discrimination in the exercise of our public roles. I believe when people bring their deepest convictions, we enrich, not diminish, public life. I think that's what Benedict was talking about, how public life is in fact deepened and strengthened when people bring their most fundamental values, including those formed because of their faith. Because if public life is not about our most fundamental convictions, then it's just, I'm afraid, about power or ego or money or interests. We contribute. We are the pluralism that they celebrate. And we celebrate. We have to be the participation that everybody calls for. Because of people like my grandmother, and maybe some of you, I always try to say what religion and politics is not about, what faithful citizenship or political responsibility is not. It is not about the religious practices of politicians. It's not about whether they were an altar boy, whether they were born again. We heard over and over that John Kerry was an altar boy, President Bush was born again. I remember during the last campaign, two images for me. One was that Karl Rove asked that the G8 summit be changed so the president could have his picture taken with the Pope, John Paul II. Well, they did change the date, and he did get his picture. And at least the picture in my paper was the Holy Father shaking his finger at the president, scolding him for the Iraq War and Middle East. John Kerry was challenged, rightly challenged, I thought, for his support on abortion on demand. And he said, "I am a faithful Catholic in the tradition of Pius the 23rd." So, you know, some of us aren't laughing, and that means we don't know either. There was no Pius the 23rd. Lately, we've heard a lot of talk about Obama's minister. Hillary was asked the other day, when was the last time she went to church? John McCain has gone to an Episcopal church for years and announced that he's really a Southern Baptist. I don't think those are the central questions. It is not how they talk about their faith. Ronald Reagan talked all the time about God and never went to church. Bill Clinton went to church every Sunday and seemed to have missed a couple of the commandments. So it's not what they sign up for. It is not about the political clout of religious groups. It's not about the Catholic vote. People who talk about the Catholic vote, I figure, don't know many Catholics. I always tell the story, I think E.J. Dionne, you have to be very careful now and attribute your stories. And E.G. and I can't agree who stole this one from whom, but it's the story of Mrs. O'Reilly, who's from Chicago. And it used to be that you could talk about the Catholic vote, and except for my family, it was a Democratic vote. Well, in some parts of Chicago, it still is. Mrs. O'Reilly loved her faith, her family, and the Democratic Party, not necessarily in that order. And she was very disappointed. Her son had not only become a Republican, he had moved to the suburbs. But it was that Republican thing that really bothered her. And one day they were arguing, and The son said, Mother, if Jesus Christ himself came back as a Republican, you wouldn't vote for him. And she said, why would he change his party affiliation after all these years? Well, that may be true for Mrs. O'Reilly, but it's not true for a lot of us. And I would suggest it's not about our pastors telling us how to vote. We don't need Jesse Jacksons or Jerry Falwells. I think it's pastorally inappropriate, ecclesially divisive, theologically unwise, politically counterproductive, and it also happens to be illegal. If it's not those things, what is it? We are called to bring together our principles and our political choices, our values and our votes, to help build a society more respectful of human life, a more just nation, and a more peaceful world. Benedict, in his remarkable letter, Deus Caritas Des, we were talking on the way over, that this Holy Father has not been what a lot of people expected. Who would have thought that his first encyclical would be about love? Who would have thought you could have summarized it in the words of an old Beatles song? All you need is love, you know? John, Paul, George, Ringo, and Benedict? I mean, it doesn't work. And he says there are three things which make the church the church: proclaiming the gospel, celebrating the sacraments, and caring for the least of these. He also said, and this made a huge difference for the bishops in writing Faithful Citizenship, and I think it is the best description of the church's role in public life. He says it is not the church's responsibility to make this teaching prevail in political life. Rather, the church wishes to help form consciences in political life and to stimulate greater insight into the authentic requirements of justice, as well as greater readiness to act accordingly, even when this might involve conflict with situations of personal interest. So the role of the church is to form consciences so that we might have greater insight, that we might know more, so that we could act even when that conflicts with our own interests. That's the role of the church. He goes on to say the church cannot and must not remain on the sidelines in the fight for justice. And I think one of the most important things that has been said in the last 25 years by our Holy Fathers: charity, love, must animate the entire lives of the lay faithful, and therefore also their political activity lived as social charity. We used to have a discussion, you know, which is more important, charity or justice, caring for those in need, or trying to deal with the structures that left them in need. Benedict breaks those walls down and says, if you love, if you are charitable, that has to form your entire life, and you have to carry that charity, that love, into political life. And he gives it a name, social charity. So what does it mean to practice social charity, to form consciences, to act differently, to bring good news to the poor, to choose life? Well, the context for this, the church talks about the signs of the times. I have a different metaphor. I was in Hawaii about 2 weeks ago, and someone who is in my shape, you know, by that I mean the shape I'm in and the shape I have, I find surfing fascinating. You know, it would be, you know, just not an option. So I watch these people. What struck me about this is they have to know the waves, obviously. They have to know the currents, and they have to know where the rocks are. So I think in some ways, when it comes to religion and politics, we're surfing or whitewater rafting. There are lots of currents that are pushing us along. There are a lot of rocks in the way, and we've got to know where they are if we're going to get to where we want. We're a challenged church. We're a wounded nation. We're a broken world. We have a divided economy, culture of violence, in our demoralized politics. 1 minute on the first five. We're a challenged church. Part of that is affirmative challenges. How do we share the faith? Today, there was a meeting about the identity of Catholic universities. How do we be truly Catholic, truly Jesuit, and truly a university? How do we pass on the faith? How do we have leadership? How do we have vocations to religious life? To priesthood. How do we apply our principles? Those are the affirmative challenges we face. There is some real burdens we bear as a result of the sex scandals. I not only work for the bishops, I'm a parent, and I have some passion about this. Trust was broken. Lives were destroyed. Horrible damage was done. And our church has to own that, and we have to fix that. Part of fixing that are the policies, are the commitments, are the efforts to reach out to victims. Part of fixing that is carrying out our mission effectively. Another challenge for us is I find that some of the polarization, the intense polarization in political life, is seeping into ecclesial life. Does your politics shape your faith, or is it the other way around? Last time around, there was a thing called, I call it some Catholic answers. You know, it had some of the answers. There's a website called Faithful America. Unborn children don't make the agenda for Faithful America. There's the non-negotiables people, and there's the everything is negotiable people. My experience is this is more about winning elections than it is about living our faith. I think we're still wounded. Benedict will go to Ground Zero on Saturday, and it will touch us, I think. We're still wounded by what happened there. We're at war. I desperately wish, our leaders had listened to John Paul. Our leaders had considered the questions our bishops raised. They did not, and we're paying a terrible, terrible price for that. I was with Cardinal Laghi before and after he met with the president as the emissary from John Paul II. And virtually everything he warned our president of has happened. But it was not just the president. The Congress didn't ask these hard questions. So we're at war, and frankly, very few of us are sacrificing for this war. The only sacrifice I have made is I can't take my shampoo on an airplane with me. 80%, 4 out of 5 Americans believe we're headed in the wrong direction. We're a wounded nation. We live in a divided economy. It's still the most powerful, productive economy on earth, but it's pushing us forward in some ways and it's pulling us apart in other ways. Some people are moving ahead. Dramatic gains. We read about the hedge fund people, you know, millions and millions of dollars. Other people are left behind. Homeless, hungry. I work for the church. I'm a church bureaucrat. I make a wonderful living. Don't tell the bishops that. I refinanced my home for the 5th time to pay for my kids' education. What if you don't have a home? What if you don't have equity? There are a lot of us working harder for less, spending less time with our kids. We're squeezed. And then we're much more familiar, sadly, with the other economy that where people live in the shadows without the right papers, without the right status, where they can be exploited or demonized. How many here remember praying for the conversion of Russia after Mass? It worked, you know. The wall fell, communism collapsed, and everything was supposed to be better. Well, it is for some people. But imagine tonight we were in Baghdad. Tiny little Christian community talking about this. An archbishop murdered 3-4 weeks ago. In Baghdad, some neighborhoods in Baghdad, Christian families are given 3 choices and 72 hours. You can leave, you can convert, or you can be killed. Imagine we were in Bethlehem today. In some ways, the holiest place on earth. In other ways, the saddest place on earth. Surrounded by a wall, occupied by Israel, threatened by Islamic fundamentalism. Imagine we were talking about the future of the Christian community in the place where Jesus was born. Imagine we were in Beijing tonight, talking about how our faith should shape our public participation If we were meeting about religion and politics in Beijing, somebody would go to jail. I would hope it'd be Father Ham. It was his idea. Half the world lives on $2 a day, and we need not just a better world, not just a safer world, but a better world, a more just world. The bishops talked about a culture of violence. Our Holy Father, called John Paul, talked about a culture of death. When they said that, it seemed really harsh to me. It doesn't seem very harsh anymore to me. I think we're a society in moral disarray. Some of that is, you know, what's on the internet, on our iPods, although I don't know how to do that, on TV. Have you ever noticed the only people who don't have sex on TV are married people? You know, we have no fun at all. But it's not just so the cultural stuff. It is the temptation to solve our most difficult problems with violence. 1 million abortions a year. The Supreme Court yesterday said we could proceed with executions again. Advocacy of euthanasia and assisted suicide in our country. An increasing resort to war to deal with international problems. Our bishops have said a nation which destroys its young, abandons its old, and relies on violence and vengeance is in fundamental moral trouble. The state of Florida is going to kill the person who has killed the doctor who is killing unborn children to teach us that killing is wrong. I don't think it's working. So we turn to public life as a way to address some of this. I think Washington is demoralized. It's demoralized in the sense that it can't get its act together. That, as I said, it's polarized, paralyzed. We can't do basic things. We can't handle a hurricane. We can't fight a war. We can't pass an immigration bill. In other ways, we just lost our ways, our moral boundaries. I'm from Minnesota. I went through the airport and tourists were taking pictures of the bathroom where Senator Craig was arrested. That's what my city's known for. There's one part of that story I like when, and it's a terrible story, but when the policeman arrested the senator gave him a card which says, United States Senate. He said, what do you think of that? And the Minnesota policeman said, well, no wonder we're in so much trouble. One of the ways that we're in trouble is our priorities are just missing. Nobody's really talking about unborn children in this campaign. Nobody's talking about the least of these. Nobody's talking about immigrants. I was up in New Hampshire, and I was fascinated by what went on, but if you listen to the Democrats, it's whatsoever you do for the forgotten middle class, you do unto me. I was impressed, frankly, with Governor Huckabee. One day, immigrants were children of God who should get in-state tuition. The next week, they were children of God who should be deported. You know? That's not our values, our agenda. And I think the problem is too much individualism in different ways. On the right, some parts of the right, some parts of the Republican Party, it's economic individualism. The market will solve every problem. You're on your own in lots of ways. I admired the president's compassionate conservative agenda. I think it was put to work in Africa. But in America, my experience was the conservatism trumped the compassion. And on the left, and some Democrats, a lot of Democrats, it's lifestyle individualism, which makes choice the ultimate criteria in public life. You can run for president and agree with almost anything. You can vote for the war, you know, but you better not have any reservations about abortion on demand. The good news is there is a renewed focus on faith and public life, on religion and politics. There's a bunch of new books. The bad news is that it's often superficial or simplistic. We had the faith forum last Sunday night. I thought it was impressive. First of all, Democrats were talking about faith. It was Senator McCain that didn't come. But I was struck by the fact that the religious leaders asked about the unborn and the immigrants and the earth. And the reporters asked, what was your biggest sin? You know, faith is about more than they think. But sometimes it's a wedge issue, it's a tactic, it's a target. It can be misused. I find, and this is personal, I find the religious right more right than religious. I wonder where the least of these is in their agenda. And we all know what I would call politically correct Christians who worry about the polar bears, and they should, we should, will defend the eggs of endangered species, but not the lives of unborn children. Very often, faith is about the poetry, not the policies. It's about the rhetoric, not the realities of public life. I think there are three constituencies. It used to be soccer moms and NASCAR dads. I think dismissed Hispanics, taken for granted by some Democrats, and now demonized by some Republicans. Disappointed evangelicals who signed up for the family and the unborn and got the war and the tax cuts. And disconnected Catholics, of which I am one. A lot of focus on Catholics. The eight out of the last nine elections, the person who won the Catholic vote won the election. E.J. Dionne says we're not monolithic, but we are important. About 40% of us are predictable Republicans, about 40% of us are predictable Democrats, and 20% of us are up for grabs. And that 20% often decides who wins. So Karl Rove spent 8 years wooing us. Obama has a new committee of Catholics for that. I'm sure Hillary has the same thing. I'm sure McCain will. We're wrestling with what it means to be a believer and voter, a Catholic and American. So I think we've got a new moment. Even where I work, there's a sense our most fundamental problems are not economic or political or technical or military. They're moral, ethical, spiritual. The questions of life and death and war and peace, who moves ahead and who gets left behind. Our bishops, in their statement, through the years actually, have said we need a new kind of politics focused more on moral principles than the latest polls, more on the needs of the weak than on the benefits for the strong, and more on the pursuit of the common good than the demands of the special interests. Jim Wallace, who has written one of those new books, has a different way of describing it. He says when so many people, so many of our leaders, have their finger to the wind, we need to change the wind. That's what we're talking about. That's what this university ought to be about. That's what faithful citizenship is about. So where do you go if you come to a place like this, to people like you? We have assets. We don't make endorsements. We don't make contributions. We have a set of ideas. We have experience. We have structures. We have people. We don't make up what we believe based on the polls and the focus groups. We can't abandon the unborn because they're politically incorrect, or forget about immigrants because they don't vote. Our church has been called a lot of things that has never been called trendy. We don't make it up as we go along. We have a set of ideas about life and dignity, about work and workers, about human rights and responsibilities, about creation, about solidarity. These are not pious platitudes. They're not bumper sticker endorsements of some party's agenda. It is politically incorrect. It does not fit the categories easily of Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative. It is both clear and it is complex. It is a lot, with all due respect to our evangelical sisters and brothers, this is a lot more complicated than what would Jesus do. I think there's another way to describe our message. It's a simple word, and, Andy, and another word, but. And here I want to be clear, I'm talking about the conjunction, not the noun. Human life and dignity, human rights and responsibilities, family and community, priority for the poor and the vulnerable, the dignity of work and the rights of workers, solidarity and subsidiarity, care for the planet and for the people on the planet, and the common good, which is really all the ands put together. I'm going to just talk about a couple of these. I'm falling behind here. Human life and dignity. Look at the structure of this. Human life comes first. Without life, nothing else is possible. No other rights have meaning. But without dignity, life is not truly human. In our politics, people try and pull apart life and dignity. Choose one or the other. That's not who we are. This is the core of our teaching on abortion and euthanasia. And in different ways, on the death penalty, on war, on health care. We start with, we insist on the right to life. Without that right, nothing else has meaning. We also insist on the right to those things which make life truly human. Faith and family, work and education, housing and health care. For us, 47 million people without health care coverage is not a soundbite. It's a moral challenge. It's a test of our faith. And we believe we have a responsibility to secure those rights, not only for ourselves, but also for all of God's children. Solidarity and subsidiarity. We belong to each other. And institutions have to work together. Large institutions should not overwhelm small institutions. The government should not interfere with family life. On the other hand, when families cannot meet their needs, they have a right to look for help from the larger institutions of state and society. Think about Katrina. Solidarity was when we saw those pictures, we said, those are members of our family. We have to act. And this university acted, I bet. Think about Katrina. The city failed. The state failed. The nation failed. We turned a natural disaster and turned it into a man-made catastrophe. The common good is all those hands put together. The but, again the conjunction, all life is sacred, but not all issues are equal. 1 million abortions a year are not the same as a cut in the WIC program. The culture of life begins with the protection of unborn children, but it doesn't end there. The children in Africa dying of hunger are just as precious to us as children being destroyed in America. We believe in faith-based institutions, but government still has an essential role. We believe the market is the best way to organize the economy, but there are some things the market does not offer effective need responses to. Healthcare might be one, environment. So that leads us to different questions. It's not just the economy, stupid. It's not just are you better off. It's not just who's ready on day one or who will bring the most change. Who can protect us or cut taxes as much as we hear those things. As I said, it's life and death, war and peace. It's about people. It's about people's lives. We have experience. It's not just what we do that matters. It's not just what we believe that matters. It's what we do. Who feeds the hungry? Who shelters the homeless? Who cares for the sick? Who educates the young? We're the largest non-governmental provider of education, healthcare, and human services in the country. We have structures. We have a university here in Omaha. We have a diocese. We have parishes. We have schools. Catholic Relief Services is in 100 countries serving the poorest people on earth in our name. We were globalized before globalization was cool. And we have leaders. Benedict. Why is every... I mean, you can't turn on the television. It's because what we stand for, I think. We have people, and I think we're just realizing a portion of our potential. Think of the people in this university, the students, the faculty, the staff, the alumni. What difference could be made? The scriptures say without a vision, the people perish. Well, it's also true without a people, the vision is invisible. How do we put together the vision and the people? A friend of mine said, if you ever got your act together, you'd be dangerous. How do we get our act together? How do we carry out our mission? I want to emphasize this is the work of the whole church, especially the laity, laymen and women like us. But I'm going to talk about the work of the bishops. For 32 years, through 8 elections, they have offered a statement on political responsibility and faithful citizenship. It is the most wisely used and occasionally misused resource. There were 8 statements. I've read them all in the last 2 weeks. Hundreds of pages. depending on your point of view, it's our greatest hits or it's where we went wrong. First thing to say about the bishops' conference is it is the bishops' conference. People who don't like what the bishops do want to blame people like me. I can't say hello to some people without being authorized. For this faithful citizenship, a committee of chairmen and bishops reviewed every amendment line by line, tens of hours. The reason the bulletin insert is so small that you can't read it is because they could not agree on what else to cut. And they had to agree. I have a staff perspective. It's a limited perspective, but I was there when they wrote the first one, and I was there when they wrote the last one. All that means to some people, my wife, is I'm a lot older. But I would argue that I had no idea when this started how visible, how controversial, how important this would be. Important to remember this emerged in 1976. We have controversy now. We had controversy then. Cardinal Bernardine, the author of The Consistent Ethic, was accused of partisanship. He had said he was encouraged by President Ford and discouraged by Governor Carter. And we've gone through that, Kerry and Cuomo, the communion conference. The thing I would emphasize, and I'm going to skip a lot of this, is when this started, this was not a big deal. This was a simple summary of what the church taught and what the conference had advocated. It was almost mechanical how it was put together. It drew on the church in the modern world, Paul VI's letter on a call to action. The general secretary of the conference asked a 26-year-old to do the first draft. It was not a very important thing, or he wouldn't have asked me to do it. And it went to the administrative committee, and it was passed without much controversy. And here are some wonderful quotes, which I'm not going to read except for one. We do not seek the formation of a religious voting bloc, nor do we wish to instruct persons on how they should vote. Over the last 32 years, we've had continuity and change. It's always been a summary of Catholic teaching. It's always talked about the role of the church and emphasized the responsibility of the laity. It's always tried to lift up our assets. It's always tried to apply the principles to specific policies. It's always emphasized participation. It's never told Catholics how to vote. It's never been a voter's guide. It has always tried to start with the common good. And it always, but in different ways, placed a priority on human life and dignity. The first time, it was by alphabetical order. Abortion came first. Then other things happened, but in different ways. It was preeminent, it was fundamental, it was first. Now we talk about intrinsic evils. What has changed? It's gone from political responsibility to faithful citizenship. A more religious way to talk about that. I love this. Everyone wants it to be shorter, and everybody wants to add 6 paragraphs. So it started short, got longer, got shorter, got longer, got shorter. The initial part of the statement always had a context. You know, what encyclical had been written, who would come, 9/11. The way the issues were lifted has changed, as I suggested. The process has changed. As I said, originally it was quite mechanical. Then it was a few committees where other people contributed sections. The thing I want to emphasize is this process that produced this document involved every key committee of the conference. It involved every bishop in the conference. They reviewed 3 drafts. They debated it. They discussed it. They amended it. And they voted it about 200-3. And I would tell you, you probably don't watch this very carefully, I don't think the Trinity could pass with only 3 negative votes. This is a matter of a lot of consensus. I'm going to skip this. The big change, I think, through the years is there has been greater clarity on the distinctions between issues and the links among them. Although at the very beginning, it talked about affirmation of human rights and denunciation of their violation. And this document talks about the opposition to oppose what is intrinsically evil and the similar obligation to pursue what is good. A lot of issues were added and emphasized. The consistent life ethic became integrated into this. I had a guy at a talk said, I hate that stuff about the seamless garment. This document never referred to the seamless garment. It has always talked about the consistent ethic of life, which treats all issues, which does not treat all issues as morally equivalent, nor does it reduce Catholic teaching to one or two issues. I would argue the seamless garment is neither. It is not seamless. It involves different issues with different moral reasoning and different consequences. And it's not a single garment. It's not a way to throw a cloak over all the decisions we made. It's not a menu. It's not a scorecard. It's not an escape or excuse for those who want to ignore abortion or want to ignore the poor. Again, this is from Cardinal Ratzinger before he was our Holy Father, and I think it is a great summary of what the consistent ethic calls us. A well-formed Christian conscience does not permit one to vote for a political program or an individual law which contradicts the fundamental context of faith and morals. The Christian faith is an integral unity, and thus it is incoherent to isolate some particular element to the detriment of the whole Catholic doctrine. A political commitment to a single isolated aspect of the Church's social doctrine does not exhaust one's responsibility towards the common good. So it moves in two ways. You cannot embrace or support what is evil, and you cannot stop having opposed what is evil. You have an obligation to pursue what is good. So that brings us to this statement. It begins with the Holy Father's call to conscience. It is built around two foundations, and I actually am wrapping up here. The two foundations are conscience and prudence. Conscience, forming conscience. When we talk about conscience, at least when I talk about conscience, it's usually a way to do what I want to do. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to follow my conscience. Conscience requires us often to do the hard things. What we don't want to do, to sacrifice, to restrain ourselves, to choose the poor and vulnerable instead of the rich and powerful. Prudence always sounds to me like a cautionary virtue. You know, the first President Bush, we made fun of, wouldn't be prudent. Prudence can require action. Prudence can require courage. Climate change requires prudence, requires us to act. Two duties. To resist what is evil and to pursue what is good. That sounds easy. It is not easy to resist what is evil in this culture. The destruction of unborn children. The execution of criminals. Torture. Pursue good. It's not easy to stand up for the poorest people in the country or on the planet. Two temptations. To make no distinctions among issues. To treat everything as equal, or secondly, to use those distinctions to emphasize what you want to and say nothing else matters. I'm pro-life, stop talking about the war. Or when are you going to get over that fixation on abortion? I really like what you're saying about the death penalty. In the end, what this calls us to is more, not less involvement. It talks about being politically homeless. And I feel that way. But we need to build a home. We need to build a structure, a shelter at least. We need more people, more Catholics involved, running for office, active in both parties, standing up for what we believe, lobbying the legislature, being present in the campaigns. Ours is a call to participation. This document was generally well received, but it disappointed some people on the extremes. Catholics for a Free Choice and the American Life League, for different reasons. The New York Times said it was a roadmap for voting for a pro-choice candidate, and the Washington Post printed an article said you would go to hell, according to the bishops, if you voted for a Democrat. It's a lot more complicated than that. What it really requires is more participation. I remember my daughter Kelly came out of Mass one Sunday, focused on something other than the Sunday homily. And she said, you know, when I graduate from college, I'm going to work a few years, and then I'm going to run for Congress. I thought, this is just great. You know, she really got the message. Her mother had a somewhat different reaction. She said, well, maybe you ought to register to vote first. Well, we need more Catholics running for office, but we need every Catholic registered to vote and voting their conscience, their informed conscience. It is important to suggest that partisan political activity is not all of politics. What we do between elections is important. What goes on here? I saw is it the Jesuit Advocacy Corps on the website where people work? The Nebraska Catholic Conference. Some people use our action alerts to actually write letters and make phone calls. Some people belong to Right to Life or Bread for the World. Some of the best work is done in community organization funded by the Catholic Campaign for Human Development that's making real change in real lives. We are making a difference on lots of issues. In the end, what our bishops say about the church, I think, is a good description of what the call is for us as an institution, not as an individual. We are called to be political but not partisan. We're not to be cheerleader for any candidate, chaplain for any party, advocate for any administration, but to challenge them all. We're to be principled but not ideological. We're not going to compromise on the fundamentals, on life, on war, on peace. But we can work with anybody to advance those principles in different ways. We need to be civil but not soft. We need to make our case clearly but not impugn anyone's motives. We shouldn't be calling people baby killers or war criminals. We're in the persuasion business, and that's probably not the best way to persuade. And we need to be engaged but not used. We need to have relationships with our political leaders, but it ought to be around our concerns, not theirs. Our interests, not theirs. A chance to talk through what we care about in terms of the poor, the unborn, the immigrants, not just pose for a photo op. This is really important, how we do it. It is important to our country, it is important to our church. I would argue it's important to our world. I made a pilgrimage, I'll conclude with this story. I was with a group of priests and we made, as I said, a pilgrimage. It was a trip to Ground Zero, where the Holy Father is going on Saturday. And it was an overwhelming physical, spiritual, emotional experience. The fires were still burning, the smoke was still rising. Twice while we were there, they brought out, everything stopped while they brought out pieces of people. And one of the priests came up to me and grabbed me by the shoulder and he said, "John, the only way we're going to overcome this hate, this horror, is by what we were talking about last night. Respect for human life, for human dignity. A sense of solidarity that we're in this together. Some sense of justice. Some sense of concern for one another, a pursuit of peace. Respect for human life. Who could do this? We have to stand up. We have to make a difference." He said, "The work you do is more important than ever." And I, of course, turned to him. I said, "Father, the work you do to preach the gospel, to build the community, to help us act on our faith is more important than ever." And I would say at a really important time for our country, in the middle of a very important election with a lot of tough choices, at a time of real opportunity and real trouble for our church, at a time of real promise to this university, this is the time to put what we believe, what we do, what we know, and what we can accomplish together in real and effective faithful citizenship. Thank you very much.